Hello, and welcome to this week's Undisclosed Addendum, where we talk about all things undisclosed. This is Colin Miller, one of the hosts of Undisclosed, filling in this week for the tremendous Kevin Flynn. Today we're going to talk about episode 4 of the Jason Carroll series, so if you haven't yet listened to that episode, hit that pause button, give it a spin, and we'll be back here waiting for you. Today I'm joined by two guests. The first is our old friend Bob Ruff. Bob Ruff is a former fire chief and arson investigator who left his position at the fire department in 2015 to pursue his work helping the wrongfully convicted. In 2016, he created NBI Studios, his own podcast network that is dedicated to educating the public about the shortcomings of our criminal justice system and providing a voice for the victims of violent crimes. His podcast, Truth and Justice, is currently in its, its 11th season, Bob. It's played a role in 3 overturned convictions and the release of an innocent man on parole based upon innocence. Earlier this year, Bob launched his new podcast, True Crime Binge. Each week, he invites another true crime podcaster on the show to highlight their work and bring exposure to the cases they cover. Bob, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Colin. And you're next, by the way, on True Crime Binge. We need to pin that down.
Sounds good. Let's do it. Second guest is Rabia Chowdhury, of course, the lead investigator and one of the hosts of the Undisclosed podcast, author of the New York Times bestseller Non-Story, and host of other podcasts, including The Hidden Gin. Rabia, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Colin. I'm never not here. I'm always on this call. Every week, over and over.
Can I just say that I love The Hidden Gin so much, by the way?
Like, did you listen to it?
Yeah, I haven't listened to all of it, but I've listened to this. Like, I love your voice and the stories. I love the whole concept.
Thanks. People think it's like just spooky stories, but it's actually pretty like highly researched and got academic resources. And it's, but it was fun to make. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, it's a great. I'm listening to it too, and it's. I really love it, Rob.
Colin, that's so exciting.
You only like said nobody, that because I said it.
None of my friends. I'm like, my friends don't listen to my podcast. But thank you, guys.
Sure.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, so in this week's episode of Undisclosed, we learned about the supposed existence of a person named Bob that Sharon may have gone to meet in the night of her murder. The police, of course, don't learn about Bob from Ken initially. In fact, early on, he denies knowing this person entirely. But then later, he presents numerous different stories about Bob and the police spend months hunting this person down with no success. We also learn about the possible financial windfall that Ken stood to gain if Sharon died. We'll talk more about that episode in a bit, but first, Bob, as I mentioned, you have this new podcast, True Crime Binge. What can you tell our listeners about True Crime Binge?
Yeah, so True Crime Binge was actually born in the pandemic. The case I was working on in Truth and Justice, the person we were trying to help actually died of COVID in prison, and it was at a time when we couldn't get access to any records. The courthouses were shut down, didn't really know what to do, had a lot of podcaster friends that were in the same boat. So for season 9 of Truth and Justice, I had this idea that every week I'll interview another podcaster and let them talk about their podcast, and then we'll highlight a case every week. And my listeners just loved it. And once we got back into our regular Truth and Justice season in season 10, we split it off and then continued that format with True Crime Binge, which so every week I have another podcaster on. A lot of them, the idea is if it's a podcast you love, we get into some personal details and stuff, and you learn about the podcaster and how they got into podcasting. And if it's a podcast you've never heard of, you learn the same thing, and then you also learn about the show. We talk about a case every week, and so people find their, hence the name, find their next big true crime binge on it. It's been really popular. It's a lot of fun for me because I get to talk to. I think we've got 50 or 56 episodes just dropped this week, so we've got a lot of podcasters. Robbie has been on.
Yes.
Colin's going to be on very soon, hopefully Susan soon. and it's been a lot of fun, and it's been a lot of the listeners really like the fact that they're finding their podcast feeds are filling up as they're listening to it.
Great. Well, you mentioned, of course, your original podcast, Truth and Justice, which I've also been listening to. And on last week's addendum, we had Amber Hunt, another true crime podcaster, and she expressed the sentiments basically of many listeners. I have to check the title of the series. Is it Jason Carroll? Because we have what seems to be an obvious suspect, and Jason Carroll is not in the picture yet. And Bob, I've been listening, and it seems your listeners have the same reaction to your new season about Pablo Velez. which seems similar to this case in that he's an out-of-left-field suspect. So can you give our listeners the 411 on Pablo Velez and his case?
Pablo Velez, I didn't intend to do this, but he's actually the fourth case in a series of Harris County, which is Houston, Texas, of just absolute insane corruption. Our season 10 case, the Jennifer Jeffley case, was also Houston PD, Harris County DA's office. That one involved a 15-year-old
girl. They must love you down there.
Oh, I'm their favorite. Yeah. Ever since the Sandy Melgar case, which was the first one we did in season 6. Yeah. And in that case, it was a 15-year-old girl that was questioned for 7 hours with no lawyer or parent present. Her mom was continuously calling and they kept telling her, oh, she's just a witness. We'll have her home soon, while they're violating Texas law. And ultimately, one of the detectives ends up typing out a confession and having her sign it as an accessory. And then she ends up getting life in prison for it. So we had worked on that case, and because of that, we were reached out to by the advocates for a guy named Charles Raby. We did that kind of, we did some bonus episodes between seasons. We covered Charles's case, exact same detective, exact same story, Detective Wayman Allen from Houston, who had elicited a false confession out of him. Same scenario, didn't record anything, typed it out, had him sign it. And then Pablo Velez's case also came out of the Harris County. Same cops again, Roy Swainson, who worked both, you know, all these other cases as well.
It's always the same cops, man.
Yeah, it's the same thing. And in Pablo's case, they had a legitimate reason to look into him initially. So there was the getaway car in the case. Somebody followed it, caught the license plate number, and it came back to Pablo. But what we learned in the podcast is very easily Pablo was able to prove that he had sold that car to someone else. And in fact, literally, according to the detective's notes that were uncovered, weren't turned over to the defense. But according to the detective's notes that were found years later, they wrote in there, everybody, his exact words were, everybody at the scene told them these three guys did it. And Pablo wasn't one of them. And they went ahead and convicted him anyway, even with their star eyewitness telling the DA, who came face to face with the real shooter, that's not him. And she spun that by telling in her opening argument, she told the jury that, well, she's probably not going to be able to ID him, but the police officers will be able to. And Detective Swainson, again, who wasn't in the room when she gave the ID, said that he was, and said that she gave a perfect ID. But we still got a lot more to go on that case. But yeah, those are kind of the basic beats. It's
just
horrendous.
It makes my stomach turn. It makes my stomach. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, it's enraging. Why? I do not understand a prosecutors and officers like this. Why? Why, when you have a clear-cut case, are you going to do this?
Yeah, and what I've found in Harris County is there seems to be a serious levels of systemic racism in that department, certainly back at that time. And what we find is in all these cases, we have Latina and Latino victims and also people of color who are the main suspects. And it reads as total apathy, like they're not people. They're just trying to close a case. Like, who cares if we find the correct killer? It was just this Hispanic woman, so who cares, is what it looks like. There's no other explanation for it.
Yeah, it's funny, Bob, with Jennifer Jeffley, actually, I was starting to do some research into her case, thinking about covering an Undisclosed, and then I saw, oh, Bob's covering on Truth and Justice. It's a crazy case. I definitely recommend listeners tune into that if you haven't listened to the Truth and Justice Jennifer Jeffley season.
Yeah, thank you. It was another insane case. In another case, much like this one, where all signs were pointing to this person is the one who did it, and police never questioned them. And I had the same sentiment as Amber, who was also on True Crime Binge, Colin.
Yeah.
But as I'm listening, I just finished the fourth episode of this season yesterday, and it was the same thing. I had to keep looking back. I'm like, wait, is this about Ken?
Yeah.
I'm like, no. Some guy named Jason Carroll we haven't heard of. I love what you're doing, and I guess I would ask you guys, was that it had to be an editorial choice to lay the real case out first? And as someone who does something that's very similar on my show, like whose idea was it to lay it out that way, or is it just the way the cards played?
Yeah, no, I mean, I thought a lot about, like, which way, like, do we start with the arrest of Jason Carroll and work our way backwards? But I did, like, in episode one, like, in the introduction, right up front, say this is about a conviction against a man named Jason Carroll, and it's a conviction based on no evidence other than his own confession. But then I decided that we're going to start from ground zero, and just what I want to do, because as I was investigating this case, I was... and following the footsteps of the officers, I was doing the same thing. I'm like, well, where's Jason? Where does Jason's name finally appear in the documents, right? It takes like a thousand pages into the records before you get to a Jason character. And so I kind of wanted to take the listeners on the same journey so they are as shocked and kind of like sideswiped as I was, because it took me a long time, because I go through the investigative documents chronologically, so I know exactly, like, you know, the police went from here to here to here, this is what happened day by day, and I'm like, where's Jason, right? Like, so I wanted to replicate that sense of horror in the listeners.
I like it, and for me it's made me think.
We're almost there though.
Yeah, I was just discussing it with our producer, Mike, before I came in here. It was like, you know, this is an interesting approach, because I typically go the other way. You know, I kind of tell the story, and then he was convicted. This is how they convicted him, and let me explain to you why that's wrong. And a lot of times it's hard for listeners to go on that ride back and forth. Like, now you kind of made me think he's guilty. But yeah, I like what you guys are doing.
Yeah. Listen, one way or the other, your listeners might be frustrated about some some of your choices, but right. Whatever makes sense. And then I think every season that I've done, at least, I usually end up going kind of in that order, but usually it doesn't take this long to get to the defendant. Usually you're there by the second episode or so, at least.
Yeah. I can't wait to hear how they even got him on their radar, because it certainly seems like there was a pretty obvious path.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Bob, you're talking about all these Harris County cases, and we've certainly done our share of cases in one location, like Pennsylvania and Philadelphia. And, Rabia, you mentioned how late Jason Carroll comes into the investigation. So this Twitter question by Karen Almeida is, are you beginning to find more and more similarities of the such cases you cover? How does this influence your upcoming cases? So, Rabia, to me at least, the Jason Carroll case feels very different than any other case we've covered. Is that your sense, too, or do you see analogies to prior cases?
Yeah, I mean, I think this might be maybe just one of two cases in which there's like overwhelming evidence for who actually committed the crime. But in most cases, that doesn't happen. In a lot of undisclosed cases, it's kind of a murder mystery at the same time. We're trying to figure out who did it. And we may or may not ever know. All we can do is, to a reasonable degree, prove that our defendant didn't do it. So I think that's one of the reasons this is really different, is because, come on, guys, it's like clear as day here. But at the same time, yeah, you do see similarities in the sense of, you know, kind of the investigative gaps that take place. Another reason I would say, though, although this is different also, is that the investigation was pretty thorough compared to other investigations and other cases we've covered, which are often like really shoddy, or they involve officers who seem to have a pattern and a history of like doing stuff like they're doing in Harris County with Bob's cases. So it is a little bit of a different case, I think, in that sense.
And how about you, Bob, with Pablo Velez? Kind of similar to this, there's some obvious suspects. There's this fight that occurs a few days before the murder. There's people seen there the night of the murder. And then Pablo Velez comes in. As you say, there's this vehicle which is spotted that they used to tie him to the crime. But is this different than your other cases, or is it similar to some of your prior cases?
It actually is a little bit different for me, because a lot of times I'm kind of looking for that murder mystery case, right? In the cases where we've done, you know, Jeff Lee's case was a good example. I didn't know when I started it who did it. I didn't like the way it went down, and I wanted to investigate to see if Jennifer didn't do it. And we ended up, I think, figuring out who did do it. But in this case, this will be a shorter season for us. I kind of listed it as it probably be kind of a mini season because of the fact there's so much overwhelming evidence as to who did it that you know, I don't know how far we're gonna be able to go with it. I can't, you know, there's no MacGuffins here that I can try to misdirect anybody to, you know, to try to make it more interesting. It just is what it is. We know who did it. And part of this because we actually have a huge case that'll probably be run for a year or more.
Whoa.
That I'm investigating right now. But it's so – the case file is so big. It was a 27-day trial. It's an insane case, multiple defendants that I'm – this case, we're putting this out because I decided to run with it because I think that Harris County needs to be exposed. The HPD needs to be exposed even further than we've already done. And to give me more time to prepare for this, the season 12, which is going to be quite a lengthy season.
Bob, can I ask you, the Velez case, is there any chance of any new evidence, like a new witness or anything coming forward? Or you think all that's kind of like, okay.
I don't think so. And that he's got a hell of a legal team working for him already right now. And they have, I mean, you've got, so there's multiple shooters. You've got the one shooter who everybody knows did it. He was standing right there in front of everyone. Everybody knew who the guy was. He's already signed sworn statements saying that, I'm not going to tell you who was with me. I'm not going to snitch, but I'll tell you that it wasn't him. I don't know that guy. You know, wow. So yeah, so they have everything they need. So now it just becomes it's like a Nans case. It goes through all these, you know, these legal hoops that you have to jump through to get the case overturned. And it takes years. He's been in for 15 years. He's got 15 left to go if they don't overturn it. And so now it's a fight. And that's why it was actually his attorneys that brought the case to me, because they need exposure. They need
cases
pressure.
Like that. I feel like cases like that, when you're just stuck like that, need like political solutions. You just need a new DA. You need like some,
right.
You need to change the players to get some justice is what it feels like.
And that's what, you know, that's kind of the sentiment his attorneys shared with me when they asked me to cover the case, is they're like, we just need, like, everything's so blaringly obvious that we need something to change. And they've seen what's happened with Sandy Melgar's case and with Jennifer Jeffley's. They've seen what the pressure of Truth and Justice can do to the DA's office. And they know they already don't like me. So they wanted me to go ahead and push the ball forward that way.
Good luck to him.
Yeah, well, this flows nicely into this next question, which I'm really interested to ask. And Bob, you mentioned this lengthy series you're preparing now. During our previous series for Jarrell Ewing, we had Maggie Freeling on one of our addendum episodes. It was just as she was starting her podcast, Murder and Alliance. And she recently concluded that podcast with an interesting, I think, unique conclusion, questioning whether her subject in the podcast was actually guilty and saying, I've gone as far as I can. And Rabia, I know you on Twitter had a thread talking about how you approach possible cases and vet them for undisclosed. So I'll start with you, Rabia. If you can sort of go through, as you said in the Twitter thread, when you have a potential case for undisclosed, how do you decide whether you're going to take that case and how much vetting do you do?
Well, I mean, first of all, it was a fantastic series. I listened to the entire series Maggie did. If you just listen to the final episode, she does an incredible summary and you kind of know what's happened. And then kind of the twist in terms of where they land. Now, Maggie was working with these investigators who are part of an organization that does innocence work. And she was just kind of following them along as they did an initial investigation of this possibly innocent defendant. And a number of times what was said during the podcast was that, you know, we're looking for evidence of innocence and we just can't seem to find any for this guy. And I can't say, you know, I don't know, Colin, how you and Susan approach this, but I certainly, when cases come to me, I don't look for evidence of innocence, because for most of our defendants, it's nearly impossible to provide, right? I mean, even if you look like Adnan's case, if somebody asks me, what is evidence that he's innocent? What am I supposed to produce? Other than maybe lividity might be the closest thing I can come to, right? But even that for some people is not enough. Not having his DNA on the scene for some people is not enough. So finding evidence of innocence is really hard. What I look for is evidence of guilt. And when I have a case file, I start at the beginning, like I am that initial investigator. Where is the evidence taking me? And is what those investigators found to be evidence of guilt, do I agree that that's actually evidence of guilt or not? And I've learned over the years, kind of like, you know, all the different kind of pitfalls and mistakes that we can make thinking, oh, what are the things that point to guilt? Like things like the way a person's acting, or not being able to account for their time, or not taking, you know, the stand at trial, or different things that people read as evidence of guilt, which really isn't. So my approach is very different. And if I get to the point where I'm like, there is absolutely no evidence this person did this, and there might be factors leading to other people, and that's different. That's a different determination than, can we get this person back in court? Can we find something that can help move the needle legally? So then you have to make that determination. And what would that take? Like I said, with the Velez case, it seems like what it takes is you just need different people, you know, handling the case.
Right.
So that was a little bit different. And so, I mean, what I thought was interesting in Maggie's case was that the investigators, there's a co-defendant in the case. They didn't go to him until the very end of the season. And I was shocked, because I would probably have gone to him first. You know, I mean, like, I would have started there with the co-defendant. and then gone into other stuff. And I thought that was, but maybe they would have had a very short season then. I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, so Bob, as we mentioned at the top, this is your 11th season of Truth and Justice. So same question to you, as you're vetting these cases for Truth and Justice, what are you doing in terms of your approach?
Well, I was actually going to say the exact same thing Robbie has said, that when I'm vetting a case, so I have factors that are, you know, I typically only cover murder cases. I try to cover cases that are solvable. Our goal is, you know, I don't have a legal background. I'm trying to solve the case. So typically I'm looking for something that's a personal cause homicide. You know, it's hard to investigate a drive-by shooting or something like that. But then what I do is my approach is to look for evidence of guilt. I've always said that time, technology, and attention to detail should always make the state's case stronger if they have the right person. And so I start to really narrow in on, you know, kind of put a microscope on the state's case. And if the closer I look, the weaker the case gets, that's the indicator to me that they have the wrong person. It should get stronger if you look closer. And if it starts to fall apart, that's the red flag. These situations happen. It happened in our season 8. I don't know that she was the Deborah Perringer is the one that passed away in prison. I don't know. I wasn't able to get to a point in that season where I could say I conclusively believe that she's innocent. I would say I was probably 50-50 at the point. There was a time when I really leaned heavily that way. But, you know, one disadvantage I have as opposed to the setup that you guys have is there's only one of me. So everything we're doing is in real time. I don't, you know, we don't take breaks. So I can't research a case for 6 months before I start it. So the listener's kind of going on that journey with me. So there's a heavy screening process. I'm looking for those evidence of guilt. I'm putting a microscope on the state's case and see if it gets weaker. And then if it meets that standard, and I believe there's most likely an injustice there, then we launch and then we go for it. I am very lucky though. Now I have, for the first time, I finally asked for help from my audience. You know, the whole idea behind Truth and Justice is it's crowdsourced investigation. You know, the audience helps out with the process, and people are always asking me to help. And I always kind of kept things to myself, but for case selection this time, I asked for volunteers to be on the research team to select a case.
Fantastic.
And it's amazing. So, and I can't believe I never did it before. So now I have an Innocence Project attorney, another attorney, a former PI, a former law enforcement officer, two people who have like master's degree in library research.
Amazing.
And someone who worked for a government agency doing public records requests. And they sort through, and then before for this season, they narrowed down to four cases. They put dossiers together for all four cases and then did this whole like 2-hour presentation to me on these cases for me to select one. So it made it a lot easier.
Oh my God, I want this team.
they're amazing. They're absolutely, and that's how we ended up with Pablo's, you know, the case we're going to launch into next. I was like, man, I want to do this case, but I need time. There's some, you know, there's some other hurdles we got to jump through with it. And then they brought up and they're like, well, we thought you'd want to see this one because there's all these factors. Plus it's Detective Swainson, who they know I hate. that was involved, and I was like, well, that we can do that one next.
Yeah, I was looking through my numbers and I found that for every 8 cases I've started vetting for Undisclosed, one has made it on to the actual series. I don't know, do you have actual numbers, or do you have any sense of how many cases you review for each case makes it to air?
For me, it's in the hundreds. We get probably through our website an average of 100 case submissions per month between the website and jail mail that we get. But, you know, as far as the vetting process, I would say 80% of those, we don't get past the first paragraph. You know, for example, and I just had one this morning that was, you know, I was falsely convicted of child abuse. I don't do child abuse cases. I don't do sexual assault cases. I don't do cases where the victim is still alive, where I'm going to have to make them relive this. So there's just absolutely no goes. I was there, but I wasn't the shooter. I don't do those cases. So, you know, a lot of those, as far as vetting goes, I'm not really vetting them so much as they just kind of don't make that first cut.
Yeah. I mean, I guess for me, probably 8-1 is not my ratio, but at least probably I reject at least 4 or 5 for everyone that makes it. Yeah.
In terms of my vetting process, I like to create a timeline, and then I like to see the evolution of witness statements as they get to trial and how they change. And Rafia, that leads to kind of the heart of episode 4, which is it's centered around Ken mopping up some muddy footprints, leaving some new ones behind. It's kind of the Watergate era. The cover-up is worse than the crime. But we got this tweet from Cyan. Did the police move on to Jason Carroll because they were just had it with trying to plot the coordinates of Ken's dreams? And so, Ravi, obviously this is an allusion to Sarah Koenig and Jay Wilds. And so my question to you is, you have gone through the files much more than me. To what extent do you see Ken's changing stories as a calculated cover-up? And to what degree do you think he might just be a pathological liar?
The answer to that is yes, both. he didn't have a great reputation. People said he lied a lot, and he would do anything to cover his rear. I also think it was a calculated cover-up, poorly calculated in many ways. As I said, I think in last week's addendum, I think Ken was deeply stupid. And yet he was wily. I mean, he managed to keep slipping through the fingers of the police. Of course, in the next episode, we've got like this larger than life, legendary police officer who's going to take over the case. And then it's going to be harder for Ken to slip through those fingers. But yeah, I mean, he, all of the Bob stuff is, what's shocking to me about reading about the hunt for Bob and all of the investigative efforts these poor officers took was it almost seemed like they believed him. I mean, every time they mentioned, he went from saying, I don't know Bob, ain't no Bob, then it's okay, well, I kind of know Bob, but he's a friend, doesn't owe me any money, to, and then when they're like, oh, somebody else told us about Bob, he's like, oh, wait a minute, there is a Bob. And then that Bob evolves, it changes. Sharon knows him, doesn't know him, has met him, has never met him. He's 5'7". No, he's 6 foot tall. No, he's 5'10". He's got dirty blonde hair. He has brown hair. I mean, the description Ken finally settles on. The funny thing is, and I just think this shows you, I mean, it's just human nature, but we do fall back on what we know. And also points to his lack of imagination. The description he actually verbally gives of Bob sounds almost exactly like Ken himself in terms of height, build, hair. But he says things like, you know, Bob's a real smooth character. And I'm like, I'm sure Ken sees himself like that. But this Bob that he's allegedly placing bets for, you know, to his friend Craig, you know, the bookie. And the bookie's like, I don't know any Bob. I don't know what you're all talking about. And the police just keep in good faith trying to look for Bob.
I think I have it figured out. Is Bob's real name Jason Carroll? Is that the twist?
You know, actually, you're not too far-fetched. The state will try to make this case. But actually, no. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, we read that one quote from one of the police reports, you know, where the officer's like, it makes me wonder if there really is a Bob. There's no Bob. Other than the Bob we have on our show today. Bob Ruff.
Right. Which, by the way, I'll tell you, I was a little confused when I read through the – I hadn't listened to the episode yet when I read through the notes for today's episode, and there's all these questions about Bob. And I'm like, how did I get roped into this?
I was like I told Meethal at the before we started the season, I said, I don't know what episode this Bob episode is going to be, but I need Bob Ruff on the addendum for this one.
Well, that leads to this question, Rabia, which is the question I was wondering myself. So, you know, obviously in the episode, Bob just asked, you know, is Bob, in fact, Jason Carroll? Well, it's really kind of like the Kaiser Soze, right, from Usual Suspects, where we present him on the podcast as he's throwing them off his scent by pretending he's someone else. But was he also possibly setting this up for Sharon? And so Logan Mackenzie Hughes asks, what if Bob's just an alias for Ken / some made-up character to lure Sharon? Maybe Ken mentioned a Bob who owes $4,000, scheduled a meeting for Sharon, but Ken is there instead. So do you think that he was using this as a ruse, not just for the police, but also for Sharon?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think towards the end of the episode is when I get into the fact that if we really kind of think about where did Sharon first learn of Bob, why does she even think a person named Bob exists? It's because her husband has told her so. To what extent she believed him or didn't believe him, I don't know. But she believed him enough to be trying to set up meetings with him, according to one of her coworkers and friends. There was a reason. I mean, I think is that Ken first began with the Bob ruse to cover his own gambling debts. The bets he's making are bets that he's making for himself, but he's come up with this elaborate, but he knows that Sharon will kick him out if she finds out he's gambling again. So he comes up with this elaborate story where there's a guy named Bob who he made the bets for. And so Bob's the one who really owes the money, even though, you know, Ken's the one who owes the money to Craig Maxfield. And that night, did she go thinking she might be meeting Bob? I don't know. She had told somebody the day before that she was going to meet Bob the next day. But she never told anybody at work. As she was leaving work that evening, everybody she told, she said that she was going to go for the lottery thing and then maybe do some shopping. She didn't mention to one person, maybe she might stop by a friend's house. So that day she didn't actually mention trying to meet anybody named Bob. But Bob was somebody that Ken created to throw Sharon off of his gambling debt scent. And yeah. So
Bob, you mentioned looking here at this script and wondering who's Bob. So Bob, what about Bob? I'm going to the title of the episode. What's your take on Bob, whether he exists, whether he doesn't? What exactly Ken is showing by positing this Bob as existing, but then changing the story so many times?
Well, that was my first thought when listening, was like, there is no Bob. There can't be. I mean, you don't know someone as well as if he's making bets for him and not know his last name and not know his phone number and not know what he looks like and keep changing, like, everything about it. I mean, this whole case to me so far, from what I heard, like, everything is screaming personal cause homicide. This Bob guy doesn't exist. What are the odds that she has this husband who's lying and creating this false person, and he tells his daughters that she had come home that night and then says she doesn't, everything with calling the police, all of that, that it just so happens he's doing all of that. And then some guy, Jason Carroll, who we haven't met yet, just happened to kill her on that same day.
Yeah.
And then Rabia, you mentioned how, right, this wasn't actually this story that Sharon was telling her coworkers. It was that she was going to get lottery tickets and cash this lottery winning that she had. And as you noted in the episode, before the police corroborate her cashing that winning lottery ticket, Ken says, I'm absolutely certain, adamant, 100%, she went and cashed in this lottery ticket because he needed this money. Why do you think he is saying he was so certain that she had cashed this lottery ticket? Does it help his case at all?
Oh, no. I think...
Or is it a slip-up?
Oh, it's a muddy footprint. I mean, it's a muddy footprint. The only way he could have known that for sure is if he had her purse afterwards, right? If he had seen that the tickets are gone and she has the cash that she said she'd have, that's the only way he would have known for sure. Or unless she literally called him after from the lottery place and say, hey, I'm at the lottery place. And we know that didn't happen. He has no way of knowing for sure. It's a weird detail. And I think the reason he put it in is because he wants to try to help fill in the story for the police as much as he can without giving away too much. So he wants to be like, no, she definitely went to Ting's. Like, he's trying to account for her time and his time. And so he really wants the police to, like, stay on this trail. I mean, I guess that's the only reason I can think of that he would insist on doing that. But I think it was just a muddy footprint that he didn't realize he was leaving. And I don't know if the listeners picked up on it or not, but the only way he could have known is if he had that purse. And, you know, look, there's the other evidence that he probably did have her purse was that he had this key that he shouldn't have had, which we talked about in a previous episode.
Robbie, are you going to, in further episodes, one thing that caught my attention that I was curious about was one of the witnesses that you were speaking to had talked about all the credit cards and the different things she would have had in her purse. And then when they went to pull the financials, Ken had said that, oh, well, she only had this MasterCard to look at. And right away I was thinking, well, so are they not checking on those other accounts? Or how does he know she only had the MasterCard? Are you going to get into that anymore? Well, or am I just putting more into it than there was?
No. I mean, I think it's an important point. I'm going to get into more in one of the episodes where I look more at Ken. Believe me, there's more there. One of the things that a lot of people who knew Sharon said was that actually Ken controlled the credit cards, even the ones that were in Sharon's name. And she had to ask him. And one person even said one time she had to beg him for the Sears credit card or one of the credit cards. So, I don't know how many she had, but, he was very controlling of the finances, including, like, you know, like we talked about earlier, picking up her paycheck. he would pick up her paycheck, he'd cash it, like give her $100 out of it, but he controlled the finances. I mean, so I'm not surprised if she had more credit card. I mean, the thing is though, they're really, it doesn't seem like the police really are able to, cause it's kind of like, where do you send a public information request to find out if somebody has a credit? Like, if they don't know it exists, how are they going to verify it? Right. Like, right. So it's really hard for the investigators to figure out what she might've had, not had.
Yeah. And so Rob, you just mentioned how Ken controlled the finances, which explains how surreptitiously he could have this P.O. box that was two towns away. And Bob, I wonder, in listening to the episode, do you have any thoughts about why, even though apparently there were P.O. boxes available in the local post office, Ken got this P.O. box that was two towns away?
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of reasons someone could do that. One I thought is – but, you have to put yourself in the time, right? So it was early 80s, right?
Late
80s. So there's no cell phones, things like that. I don't know how mail might have played into that, but I thought, like, is he having an affair? Like, he does, somehow he wants to have this P.O. box, and he doesn't want even the people at the post office to know he has it. So he goes out of the town. I don't really know. That was one thing that was baffling to me, and I'm interested to hear more about it.
Unfortunately, I don't have more to tell you about. I actually hope some listener out there is going to be like, I think I have an idea. There's actually no evidence to show that he was having an affair. It didn't mean that, I mean, that it was impossible, but there was, I mean, the police found out at the post office, but they didn't find anything, like just any connection to any woman, you know, or it's not like he started dating somebody. Some woman appeared out of the woodwork after Sharon was killed. There's just no evidence, but he definitely got the P.O. box two towns away so that nobody would, so Sharon wouldn't know. So it has to do with something that he's keeping from his wife. I don't know what it is. I kept thinking it has something to do with the gambling. And I've even talked to some police officers who worked on gambling raids and things like that back in the 80s in that area. And I said, did P.O. boxes, like, were they ever involved? Like, did gambling rings use them? And nobody I talked to had any ideas. So I don't know what Ken was doing that P.O. box, to be honest.
He's definitely hiding something, but I don't know what it would be.
Yeah. And then he's lying about it. I mean, like, the other thing is, like, why are you lying? You're lying to the police about why you got it, which it might not even be anything nefarious, except that you lied about it. So that makes me think that there's a there.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's the other big question in the episode, too, Robbie, and maybe we can give the listeners some clarity on this, which I think there's definitely some connection because he has the spare key. And the question here is from Michelle on Twitter. Did Ken have any connection at all to that house in Merrimack? He can't have chosen a random house and happened upon the spare key. I know it's common to keep a spare key under the mat, but it seems unlikely. And to Rob, you're right. His story changes about whether he saw the house or not, whether it was Sharon or not. We still aren't sure exactly how he got the key, but there's all these questions about how he's tied to this Merrimack house, right?
Yeah, this is a really weird, I mean, this is, again, it's more muddy footprints for Ken. He's trying desperately to deflect attention to this person named Bob. And he comes up with this plan, it seems, to say, listen, I can prove that Bob exists because he gave me this key. And you can check this key out. And the police do, and the key fits. But nobody who should have any information about the property or the key knows a Bob connected. Like, there's no realtor named Bob. There was no realtor involved in the sale of the property. I don't think he had a connection at all. What Ken had a connection to was building homes. There were a lot of new buildings going up. And when he did work, his work was building decks on new homes. He knew all the new building sites, all the construction sites in the area. He was not part of the crew that ever worked on this house. However, he probably just knew that this is how they operate. I'm pretty sure that trip that he took with Buddy, Buddy Bulow, that we mentioned earlier, to Merrimack, and it's crazy to me that Buddy tells the police about this trip, but then the officer never follows up and says, well, what did you do there? You just looked at a house that that him and Sharon wanted before she died, which makes no sense at all. Like, why would he do that? And Buddy, unfortunately, is deceased, so I can't ask him. And so is Mary Lou, so I can't ask her. But I'm pretty sure he ran up there and thought, okay, I'm going to grab a key to a house. And this is like my new brilliant move to, he just took one from under the mat. I mean, both the property owner and the builder, the actual builder, both said that there was a key that was left by the front door under a mat or under the stairs, like, and that was common knowledge to the subcontractors. So I think that's what happened there. I just think it was another one of Ken's crazy, you know, it was a red herring that he was just trying to, and the police were like, okay, well, they were good investigators. They're like, we're just going to follow this until we see where it takes us.
I kind of see both sides of it, Robbie, and maybe you do too, which is, as you just said, we mentioned earlier, they didn't get the search warrant to search the house, which seems crazy. They didn't follow up on what Buddy had to say, but they also did a lot of great work, including searching to the ends of the earth for Bob. And so it kind of ties into this next Twitter question from Danny Carroll. Danny asks, Robbie, you said the investigators did a great job, and yet Ken is still not charged. Talk about their investigation, where they did great. And so is that kind of it, Robbie? Like, they did some things really well, but there are some glaring oversights that lead to these gaps in the case?
Yeah, I mean, look, they did do a great job. I mean, they did the due diligence with Bob. I think that at some point they realized this is not a real thing, but they're going to make sure that they have covered every base on this case. So they look for every Bob in the area. When Ken told them, even, for example, when he was telling his story about Bob, that I was going to meet Bob that night, the night of my wife's murder. Now you're telling them this. You've never mentioned this before, right? Before he said, I was just kind of driving around. I went to a CVS. So now you're saying you're going to meet this guy, Bob, and Bob is going to get you a deal on some French door at a place called Grossman's. Well, they go to Grossman's, and Grossman's like, we don't sell French doors. You know, so like they, down to those little details, they really, you know, they dug deep. They went to Craig Maxfield, the bookie, and they made sure they knew where Craig, they verified where he was the night of the murder, you know, step by step. They went to his girlfriend. They went to the people he played softball with that night. They really did. And yet, you know, I'll never get over the fact that they never searched the Johnson home. You know, when they got the search warrant for the car, why didn't they get a search warrant for the house? I don't understand that. And the other thing they didn't do was search Ken's own person. I mean, the way Sharon was found, it was clear that she had been in a struggle, right? Like, there could have been evidence on
his
own body.
Yeah.
And they never did that. So those are the two things where I don't know and I don't understand, like, why. But beyond that, my God, I thought they did an amazing job.
So, Bob, this is your chance. What questions do you have for Robbie or me about anything you've heard so far from this Jason Carroll series?
I think I just have the, other than what I've already asked on here, that the big one is, how the hell does Jason Carroll come into this? Like, what is amazing, not just how does he come into it, and I know, obviously, you're not going to spoil that before it comes out, but I have a hard time understanding how the police disregarded Ken. So not only have this other suspect, but at some point they decided, well, nope, this guy's not the guy. And I guess you can't tell us yet how that is, but any insight you can tell us what we have coming.
Yeah. It's not so much that they think this guy's not the guy, but they think, actually, I don't even know what they think, but it's not that they come to the conclusion that Ken's not involved. They just decide that Ken is involved with other people, and Jason Carroll's not the only one. Jason Carroll will end up being one of two co-defendants who gets charged with this murder, and we're going to talk about both of them in episode. Well, we're going to get to the first one actually in episode 5 with the new investigator coming in, and that co-defendant is going to then lead us to Jason Carroll. The real question for me on a lot of this stuff was, why did they decide they needed more, another person involved? And it wasn't until I actually got to speak to the lead investigator after all these years, and he remembered the case very well, and he told me why, and he explained why, and I was like, oh my God. So we'll get to that, and I have that audio.
Oh, I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah. But my God, what happens in this case, who gets convicted, who gets acquitted, the whole thing is really mind-blowing. Yeah. We're about to turn the corner. I know everybody's going crazy. We're turning the corner starting next episode, I promise.
Yeah, it's a bit of a preview of episode 5, right, Rabia?
Yep.
Yeah, well, I can't wait till Monday.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you so much, Bob, for joining us again on the Undisclosed Addendum. And Rabia, thanks, as always, for being on all the episodes of the Addendum, this series for Jason Carroll.
Well, thank you guys so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Bob. We're going to listen. I can't wait to hear how this season turns out, but I'm really excited to hear about this big, big story you're doing next year.
It's bananas. It'll blow awesome. Your mind.
My favorite kind of cases.
Thanks for listening to this week's Undisclosed Addendum. I'd like to thank Mithil Telhan, our executive producer, and Baluki for our logo. As always, you can follow us on social media using the handle @UndisclosedPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And we'll see you back next week on Monday for episode 5 in our Jason Carroll series.